that turned on a spit over the fireplace. The young boy tending the spit, so covered with soot that the whites of his eyes were startling, gave Paul a furtive look when he came in, then quickly turned away with an expression that might have been relief. The soldiers looked at Paul, too, and one of them inched a little way down the bench they shared toward the place where their pikes leaned against the whitewashed clay wall. The rest of the denizens, dressed in rough peasant clothes, paid him the attention any stranger would receive, staring as he made his way to the landlord's counter. The woman who waited for him there was old, and her white hair, disarranged by heat and sweat, looked like something the fleece of a sheep kept out on a bad night. But the forearms, bared by rolled sleeves, looked strong, and her hands were pink, calloused, and capable. She leaned on the counter in obvious weariness, but her gaze was shrewd.
"We've no beds left."
She wore an odd smirk on her face, which Paul could not immediately understand.
"These fine soldiers have just taken the last of them."
One of the red-smocked men belched. His companions laughed. "I'd like a meal and something to drink." A dim memory of how these things worked wriggled into Paul's thoughts. He suddenly realized he had nothing in his pockets but air, and no purse or wallet. "I have no money, I'm afraid. Perhaps I could do some work for you." The woman leaned forward, inspecting him closely.
"Where are you from?"
"A long way away. The other side of the nameless forest." She seemed about to ask something else, but one of the soldiers shouted for more beer. Her lips thinned in annoyance. And, Paul thought, something more.
"Stay here,"
she told him, then went to deal with the soldiers. Paul looked around the room. The hearth urchin was staring at him again with an intensity that seemed closer to calculation than curiosity. But Paul was tired and hungry, and did not much trust his own overstrained perceptions.
"Let's talk about work you might do," the woman said when she returned. "Follow me back here, where it's less noisy."
She led him down a narrow stairway to a cellar room that was clearly her own. The walls were lined with shelves, and they and every other surface were crammed with spools and skeins, jars and boxes and baskets. Except for the small pallet bed in the corner and a three-legged stool, the room looked more like a shop than a bedroom. The landlady sank onto the stool, fluffing her rough woolen skirt, and kicked off her shoes.
"I'm that tired," she said. "I couldn't stay on my feet a moment longer. I hope you don't mind standing. I've only the one stool."
Paul shook his head. His attention had been captured by a small, thick-paned window. Through the distorted glass, he could see water moving and glinting in the moonlight outside. The inn evidently backed on a river.
"Now then,"
the old woman's voice was suddenly sharp.
"Who sent you here? You're not one of us."
Paul turned around, startled. The landlady had a knitting needle gripped in her fist, and while she showed no immediate sign of getting up from the stool and coming after him with it, neither did she look particularly friendly.
"Woodling. His name was Jack Woodling. I met him in the forest."
"Tell me what he looks like."
Paul did his best to describe what had been, after all, a rather nondescript man, seen largely in twilight and later in darkness. It was only when he remembered the white cloth tied around his savior's arm that the woman relaxed.
"You've seen him, sure enough. Had he any message for me?"
He could not think of anything at first. "Do you know who her ladyship would be?" The woman smiled sadly.
"No one but me."
"He said something about it being the old king's woods, though I shouldn't say that to anyone except her ladyship." She chuckled and tossed the knitting needle into a basket with several dozen others.
"That's my Jack, my paladin. And why did he send you to me? Where is this place you're from, beyond the nameless woods?"
Paul stared at her. There was something more than ordinary weariness in her features. Her face seemed almost like something that had been soft once, but had been frozen into harsh creases by some terrible winter. "I don't know. There's something wrong with me. I was in a war. That's all I remember. I ran away." She nodded her head as if to the sound of an old familiar tune.
"Jack would have seen that, all right. No wonder he took a shine to you."
She sighed.
"But I told you rightly enough earlier. I've no bed. The blasted robin redbreasts have taken the last of them, and with not so much as a copper to pay me for my trouble."
Paul frowned. "They can do that?" Her laugh was rueful.
"They can do that and more. This is not my land anymore, but hers. Even here, in my pitiful burrow, she sends her strutting fellows to mock me. She will not harm me. What use having one without the only person who can appreciate it? But she will make me as miserable as she can.
Who is she? I don't understand anything you're saying.
The old woman stood up, puffing out breath as she did so.
You're better off if you don't. And you're also better off not staying in this country long. It isn't very friendly to travelers anymore.
She picked her way through the sea of bric-a-brac, leading him back to the door.
I'd put you up here on my own floor, but that would only make those roundheads upstairs wonder why I'd take an interest in a stranger. You can sleep in the stable. I'll say you're going to do some hauling for me tomorrow, so you won't attract attention. I can at least give you food and drink, for Jack's sake, but you're not to mention to anyone that you met him, and certainly not what he said.
Thank you. You're very kind.
She snorted, making her slow way up the stairs.
Falling to a low estate can do that. You see so much more of the world than you did before. You become very aware of how thin the line is, of how little safety exists.
She led him back up to the noisy common room, where they were greeted by rude questions from the soldiers and the watchful eyes of the hearth boy. A caged bird, a tall tree, a house with many rooms, a loud voice shouting, bellowing, crashing down on him like thunder. Paul came up from the dream like a drowning man, surfacing to the smell of damp hay and the noises of fretful horses. He sat up, trying to shake off the disorientation of sleep. The stable door was partway open, a shadow showing lightless against the slice of starry night.
"Who's there?"
He fumbled for a weapon, an urging of some sunken memory, but came up with nothing but a handful of straw.
"Quiet!"
The whisperer was as nervous as Paul's stablemates.
"It's only me, Galley."
The shadow came closer. Paul could see that it was someone quite small.
"The potboy."
"What do you want?"
"Not to rob you, Governor."
He sounded aggrieved.
"I'd have come in quieter than that were the case. I come to warn you."
Paul could see the boy's eyes now, gleaming like mother of pearl.
"Warn me?"
"Those soldiers. They've been drinking too much, and now they're talking of coming for you. I don't know why."
"The bastards."
Paul climbed to his feet. "Did the lady send you?"
"Nah. Locked herself in her room for the night, she has. I heard him talking."
He straightened up now as Paul moved toward the door.
"Where are you going to go?"
"I don't know. Back to the forest, I suppose."
He cursed quietly. At least he had no possessions to slow his flight.
"Come on with me, then. I'll take you to a place. King's men won't follow you there, not after dark."
Paul paused, one hand on the door. There was indeed a soft clatter coming from the front of the inn across the courtyard, a noise very much like drunken men trying to move stealthily.
"Why?"
he whispered.
"Help you? Why not?"
The boy grabbed his arm.
"None of us much like them redbreasts. We don't like their mistress, neither. Follow me."
Not waiting for Paul to reply, the boy slipped out the door and moved rapidly but quietly along the wall. Paul pulled the door closed and hurried after him. Galley led him around the back of the stable, then stopped and touched a hand to Paul's arm in warning before leading him down a narrow stone stairway. The only light came from the half-moon. Paul nearly stepped off the stairs into the river before Galley took his arm again.
"Boat,"
the boy whispered, and guided Paul into a gently rocking shadow. When he was seated in the boat's damp bottom, his rescuer carefully lifted up a pole that had been lying on the tiny dock and pushed the little craft out onto the dark river. From above them came the sudden gleam of an unhooded lantern, and a clatter as the stable door was flung open. Paul held his breath until the noise of the soldiers' drunken disappointment faded behind them. The trees on the near bank slid silently past. "Won't you get into trouble?" Paul asked. "Won't they blame you when they see you've gone?"
"The lady'll speak up for me."
The boy leaned forward as if looking for some landmark in what to Paul was impenetrable night.
"'Sides, they were so knob-knocked with drink, they didn't know where I'd got to anyway. I can just say I went to sleep in the washing hamper to get away from their noise."
"Well, I'm grateful. Where are you taking me?"
"To my place. Well, it's not just mine. We all live there."
Paul settled back. Now that his sudden rousing and narrow escape were behind him, he was almost enjoying the quiet of the night, the feeling of gliding along beneath another larger river of sky. There was peace here, and companionship of a sort. "And who are we all?" he asked at last.
"Oh, my mates,"
Galley answered with a hint of pride.
"The Oyster House boys. We're the White King's men, every one of us."
They tied up the boat at a wide pier that jutted far into the river. The place where the pier touched the shore and the narrow stairs leading upward were lit by a single lantern which swayed gently in the quickening wind. Paul looked up to the shadowy bulk on the headlands. "You live there?"
"Do now. It was empty for a while."
Agile as a squirrel, Gally scrambled out of the boat and onto the pier. He reached down and pulled up a sack that Paul had not noticed. After he had set it down, he reached back a helping hand.
"All the boats stopped here once on a time. Men singing, bringing in the nets."
Paul followed him up the hillside. The stairwell had been cut into the solid rock, and the steps were narrow and slippery with night dew. Paul found he could only climb safely by turning sideways, putting the length of his foot along each step. He looked down. The lantern was burning far below. The boat had drifted under the pier.
"Don't be so slow," Gally whispered. "We've got to get you inside. Few folk come down around here, but if her soldiers are a-hunting for you, we don't want no one seeing you."
Paul leaned in toward the hill, steadying himself against the steps above him, and made his way up as quickly as he could. Despite being burdened with a sack, the boy kept bouncing back down to urge him on. At last they reached the top. There was no lantern here, and Paul could see nothing of the building except a deeper darkness spread wide against the stars. Gally clutched his sleeve and led him forward. After a while, Paul felt boards creaking beneath his feet. Gally stopped and knocked on what was unmistakably a door. A few moments later, an apparition appeared at the height of Paul's knees, a gleaming, sideways, rectangular face.
"Who's there?"
The voice was almost a squeak.
"Gally, I've brought company. Can't let you in without the password." "Password?"
Gally hissed his disgust.
"There wasn't no password when I left this morning. Open it up. But how do I know it's you?"
The face, which Paul could now see was peering through a slot in the door, scowled in a laughable attempt at officiousness.
"Are you mad? Let us in, Pointer, or I'll reach through and knuckle your pate. You'll recognize that right enough."
The slot clapped closed, then a moment later the door opened. A faint, fishy scent wafted out. Gally picked up his sack again and slid through. Paul followed him. Pointer, a small, pale boy, took a few steps backward, staring at the new arrival.
"Who's he?" "He's with me. He's going to spend the night here. What's this diddle about a password?" "That was Miyagi's idea. Some strange folk been coming around today." "And how was I supposed to know the password when I wasn't here?"
Gally reached out and rubbed savagely at Pointer's unkempt hair, then pushed him ahead of them down the dark hallway. They followed the small boy into a wide, high-ceilinged room as large as a church hall. It was lit by only a few candles, so there were more dark places than light ones. But as far as Paul could see, it was empty but for the clinging odor of dampness and river mud.
"All's well,"
Pointer sang out.
"It's Gally. He's brought someone with him."
Dark shapes emerged from the shadows. First two or three, then many, like the fairy folk appearing from their woodland hiding places. Within moments, some 3 dozen children had crowded around Paul and his guide, staring solemnly, many wiping eyes still puffy from sleep. None were older than Gally. Most were a great deal younger. There were a few girls, but the greatest number were boys, and all of them were dirty and starveling thin.
"Miyagi, why is there a password? And don't you think you might have told me?"
A small, round boy stepped forward.
"It weren't meant to keep you out, Gally. There were some folk nosing around today we hadn't seen before. I made the little uns keep quiet, and I told them all not to let anyone in who didn't say custard."
Several of the smaller children repeated the word. The excitement of a secret, or possibly a dim memory of the thing itself, clear in the hushed thrill of their voices.
"Right,"
said Gally.
"Well, I'm here now. And this is my friend..."
He frowned, rubbing the soot on his forehead.
"What's your name, Governor?"
Paul told him.
"Right. My friend Paul. And he's for the White King, too. So there's nothing to be afraid of. You lot over there, get more wood on the fire. It's cold as a brass monkey in here. M'lady sent some cheese and bread."
He dropped his sack on the floor.
"You'll never learn all the names. Miyagi and Pointer you met. Chesapeake's over there, falling back asleep already, the lazy lummox. That's Blue. She's Pointer's sister. And that's my brother, Bay."
The last named, a skinny, snub-nosed child with curling red hair, pulled a horrible face. Gally aimed a mock kick in his direction. Paul watched the Oyster House boys and girls scatter in various directions as Gally, a natural general, set them each tasks. When they were alone again, Paul turned to his guide and asked quietly,
What did you mean, I'm for the White King? I don't know anything about this. I'm a stranger here.
That's as may be, said Galley, grinning. But since you ran away from the Red Lady's soldiers, I don't think you'll be wearing her token, will you?
Paul shook his head. I don't know anything about that. I don't even know how I came to this town, this country. A man found me in the woods and sent me to the inn. Fellow with strange eyes named Jack, but I don't know anything about kings or queens.
Jack sent you? Then you must have more to say than you're letting on. Did you fight with him in the war?
Paul shook his head again, helplessly. I fought in a war, but it wasn't here. I don't remember anymore. He slumped down onto the wooden floor and put his back against the wall. The excitement had worn off, and he was exhausted. He had only managed a few hours' sleep before Galley had woken him.
Well, never you mind, Governor. We'll sort you out.
Galley handed out the bread and cheese. But Paul had eaten earlier, and although he was hungry again, he did not want to reduce the children's small portions any further. They looked so small and poorly nourished that he found it painful to watch them eat. Even so, they were remarkably well-behaved urchins, each waiting his or her turn for a mouthful of crust. Afterward, with the fire blazing and the room warm at last, Paul was ready to go back to sleep. But the children were too excited by the night's events to return to bed.
"A song!"
cried someone, and others took up the cry.
"Yes, a song! Have the man sing a song!"
Paul shook his head. "I'm afraid I don't remember any. I wish I did."
"No need to worry," Galley said. "Blue, you sing one. She's got the best voice, even though she's not the loudest," he explained.
The little girl stood up. Her dark hair hung in tangled knots around her shoulders, confined only by a band of soiled white cloth around her forehead. She frowned and sucked her finger.
"What song?"
"The one about where we come from."
Galley seated himself cross-legged beside Paul like a desert prince commanding entertainment for a foreign dignitary. Blue nodded thoughtfully, took her finger from her mouth, and began to sing in a high, sweet, and slightly wavering voice.
"The ocean dark, the ocean wide, and we crossed from the other side. The ocean dark, the ocean deep, between us and the land of sleep. Away, 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 sing oh! They called for us, but we had gone. Away, 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 sing oh! Across the sea we had to go."
Huddled with his small tribe, listening to Blue's voice float up like the sparks from the fire, Paul suddenly felt his own loneliness surrounding him like a cloud. Perhaps he could stay in this place. He could be a kind of father, make sure these children did not hunger, did not need to fear the world outside their old house.
"The night was cold, the night was long, and we had no light but our song. The night was black, the night was deep, between us and the land of sleep."
There was a sadness in it that Paul could feel, some note of mourning that sounded beneath the melody. It was as though he listened to the keening of a baby bird which had fallen from its nest, calling across the hopeless distance to the warmth and safety it had forever lost.
"We crossed the sea, we crossed the night, and now we search the world for light. For light to love us, light to keep the memories of the land of sleep. Away, 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 sing oh, they called for us, but we had gone. Away, 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 sing oh, across the sea we had to go."
The song went on, and Paul's eyes began to sag closed. He fell asleep to the sound of Blue's small voice chiming against the night. A bird was beating its wings against a windowpane, wingtips pattering against the glass in frantic repetition. Trapped! It was trapped! The tiny body, shimmering with green and purple, beat helplessly against the pane, rustling and thumping like a failing heart. Somebody must set it free, Paul knew, or it would die. The colors, the beautiful colors, would turn to ashy gray and then vanish, taking a piece of sun out of the world forever. He woke up with a start. Galley was kneeling over him.
"Quiet,"
the boy whispered.
"There's someone outside. Might be the soldiers."
As Paul sat up, the knocking came again, a dry sound that murmured through the vast oyster house. Perhaps, Paul thought, still tangled in the rags of his dream, it's not soldiers at all. Maybe it's only a dying bird.
"Get up there."
Galley pointed to a rickety staircase leading up to one of the galleries.
"Hide. We won't tell them you're here, whoever it is.
Paul mounted the squeaking stairs, which swayed alarmingly. Clearly, it had been a long time since anyone so heavy had climbed them. The furtive knocking sounded again. Galley watched until Paul had reached the shadowy upper reaches, then took a smoldering stick from the fire and crept toward the doorway. A thin blue light seeped in through the wide fanlight over his head. Dawn was approaching.
"Who's out there?"
There was a pause, as though whoever knocked had not truly expected an answer. The voice, when it came, was smooth and almost childishly sweet, but it raised the hairs on the back of Paul's neck.
"Just honest men. We are looking for a friend of ours. We don't know you."
Galley was fighting to keep his voice steady.
"Stands to reason there's no one here calls themselves your friend."
Ah, but perhaps you've seen him, this friend of ours.
Who are you, knocking on doors at such an hour?
Just travelers. Have you seen our friend? He was a soldier once, but he has been wounded. He's not right in the head, not right at all. It would be cruel to hide him from us. We are his friends and could help him. The voice was full of kind reason. But something else moved behind the words. Something greedy. A blind fear gripped Paul. He wanted to scream at whatever stood outside to go away and leave him in peace. He put his knuckle between his teeth instead and bit down hard.
"We've seen nobody. We're hiding nobody."
Galley tried to make his voice deep and scornful, with only middling success.
"This is our place now. We are working men who must have our sleep. So be off before we set our dogs on you."
There was a murmuring sound from behind the door, a grumble of quiet conversation. The door creaked in its frame, then creaked again, as though someone had for a moment set a heavy weight against it. Struggling against his terror, Paul began to creep around the upper gallery toward the door so he could be close enough to help Galley if trouble began.
"Very well," the voice said at last. "We are truly sorry if we have disturbed you. We will go now. Sadly, we must seek our friend in another town if he is not here."
There was another creak, and the latch rattled in its socket. The invisible stranger continued calmly, as though the rattling were something quite unconnected.
"If you should happen to meet such a man, a soldier, perhaps a trifle confused or strange, tell him to ask after us in the King's Dream, or in other inns along the river. Joiner and Tusk, those are our names. We so badly want to help our friend."
Heavy boots scraped on the doorstep. Then there was a long silence. Galley reached up to open the door, but Paul leaned over the railing and signaled him not to touch it. Instead, he moved to where the gallery rail stood closest to the fanlight above the door, and leaned out. Two shapes stood on the doorstep, both bundled in dark cloaks. One was larger, but otherwise they were little more than lumps of shadow in the gray before morning. Paul felt his heart speed even faster. He gestured frantically at Galley not to move. By the thin light he could see some of the children were awake and peering out of various sleeping places around the oyster house, their eyes wide with fear. The smaller of the two shapes cocked its head to one side as though listening. Paul did not know why, but he was desperate that these people, whoever they were, should not find him. He thought his heart must be pounding as loud as a kettle drum. An image came bubbling up through his panicked thoughts. A picture of an empty place, a vast expanse of nothingness in which only he existed, he and two things that hunted him. The smaller figure leaned close to the larger as though whispering. Then they both turned and made their way down the path and vanished in the fog that was drifting up from the river.
"Two of them, eh? Are those the strange folk you said you saw?"
Miyagi nodded vigorously. Galley screwed up his forehead in an awesome display of concentration.
"I can't say as I've ever heard of such before," he said at last, "but there's plenty of strange folk coming through these days."
He grinned at Paul.
"No offense, but if they're not soldiers, they're spies or something like. They'll be coming back, I reckon."
Paul thought the boy was probably right. "Then there's only one thing to do. I'll go, then they'll follow after me." He said it briskly, but the idea of having to move on so soon made him ache. He had been foolish to imagine that he might find peace so easily. He could remember very little, but he knew it had been a long time since he had been somewhere he could call his home. What's the best way out of this town? As a matter of fact, what's beyond this town? I have no idea.
"It's not so easy to travel through the squared," said Galley. "Things have changed since we came here, and if you just set out, chances are you'll walk right into the Red Lady's soldiers.
and then it'll be the dungeons for you. Or something worse. He shook his head gravely and sucked his lip, pondering.
No, we'll need to ask someone who knows about things. I reckon we should take you to Bishop Humphrey.
Who's that? Take him to old Dumpy? Little Miyagi seemed amused. That great bag of wind?
He knows things. He'll know where the governor here should go.
Galley turned to Paul, as though asking him to settle an argument.
The bishop's a smart man. Knows the names of everything. Even things you didn't think had names. What do you say?
If we can trust him. Galley nodded.
He's a bag of wind, it's true, but he's an important man. So the Redbreasts leave him alone.
He clapped his hands for attention. The children gathered around him.
I'm taking my friend to see the bishop. While I'm gone, I don't want you lot going out, and I certainly don't want you letting no one in. The password idea is a good one. Don't open the door to anyone, even me, lest they say the word custard. Got it? Custard. Miyagi, you're in charge. And Bay, wipe that grin off your fazoot. Try not to be an idiot just this once, will you?
Galley led him out the back door, which opened onto the headlands and a pine forest that grew almost to the very walls of the oyster house. The boy checked carefully, then waved for Paul to follow him into the trees. Within moments they were tramping through a wood so dense that they could no longer see the large building just a few dozen yards behind them. The morning fog was still thick and lay close to the ground. The woods were unnaturally silent. Except for the sound of his own feet crunching across the carpet of fallen needles, the boy made almost no noise at all. Paul could hear nothing. No wind rattled the branches. No birds saluted the climbing sun. As they made their way beneath the trees, with the mist swirling about their ankles, Paul could almost imagine that he was walking across clouds, hiking through the sky. The idea cast a shadow of memory, but whatever it was would not allow itself to be grasped and examined. They had walked for what seemed at least an hour, the slope slanting downward more often than not, when Galley, who was several paces ahead, waved Paul to a halt. The boy silenced any questions by lifting his small hand, then light-footed his way back to Paul's side.
"Crossroads lies just ahead," he whispered. "But I thought I heard something."
They made their way down the hillside until the land flattened, and they could see a cleared place between the trees, with a strip of reddish dirt road at its center. Galley led them alongside it with great caution, as though they paced the length of a sleeping snake. Abruptly he sank to his knees, then reached up to pull Paul down, too. They had reached the place where a second dusty road cut across the path of the first. Two signposts that Paul could not read pointed away in the same direction down the crossroad. Galley crawled forward until he could watch the spot from behind a bush, not 50 paces from the intersection. They waited in silence so long that Paul was just about to stand up and stretch when he heard a noise. It was faint at first, faint and regular as a heartbeat, but it slowly grew louder. Footsteps. Two shapes appeared out of the misty trees, coming toward them from the direction the two signs were pointing. The pair walked in an unhurried way, their cloaks dragging in the dew-sodden dust of the road. One of them was very large and moved with an odd shuffle, but both were familiar from the front porch the night before. Paul felt his gorge rise. For a moment he feared he would not be able to breathe. The figures reached the center of the crossroad and paused for a moment in some silent communion before continuing in the direction from which Paul and Galley had come. The mist eddied around their feet. They wore shapeless hats as well as the sagging cloaks, but still Paul could see the glint of spectacles on the smaller. The larger had a peculiar grayish cast to his skin, and appeared to be holding something in his mouth, for the jutting shapes that bulged his upper lip and pressed against his jaw were surely far too large to be teeth. Paul clutched hard at the mat of needles, digging furrows in the ground with his fingers. He felt lightheaded, almost feverish, but he knew that death was hunting for him on that road. No, something worse than death. Something far more empty, grim, and limitless than death. As if they sensed his thoughts, the two figures suddenly stopped in the center of the road, directly opposite the hiding place. Paul's pulse, already painfully fast, now rattled in his temples. The smaller figure bent down and craned its head forward, as though it had somehow become a different kind of creature, something more likely to go on four legs than two. It pivoted its head slowly. Paul saw the lenses spark, spark, spark as they caught light through the shadowing trees. The moment seemed to stretch endlessly.
The larger figure dropped a flat, grayish hand onto its companion's shoulder and rumbled something. In his panic, Paul could only hear words that sounded like sealing wax, then set off down the road, waddling so slowly its legs might have been tied together at the ankles. A moment later, the smaller straightened up and followed, shoulders up and head thrust forward in a sullen slouch. Paul did not release the breath burning in his chest until the two shapes had vanished into the mist, and even then he lay unmoving for some time. Galley did not seem in a hurry to rise either.
"Going back to town they are,"
the boy said quietly.
"That's as well. Plenty to keep them busy there. All the same, I think we'll stay off the road."
He scrambled to his feet. Paul got up and staggered after him, feeling as though he had almost fallen from some high place. A short time later, Gully cut across the road and led them down a smaller side road, which wound through the trees and up a small rise. At the top of the hill, rising from a copse of birch trees, stood a very small castle, whose central keep jutted like a pointed hat. The drawbridge was down. The front door, no larger than the door on an ordinary house, stood open. They found the bishop sitting in the front room, surrounded by shelves of books and curios, reading a thin volume in the light that streamed in through the entrance. He fit his wide chair so snugly it was hard to imagine that he ever left it. He was huge and bald, with a protuberant lower lip and a mouth so wide that Paul felt sure he must have a greater than ordinary number of bones in his jaw. He looked up as their footfalls sounded against the polished stone floor.
In the middle of my poetry hour, my all too brief moment for restful contemplation. Still in all,
he folded the book closed and let it slide down to the place where the hemisphere of his belly met his small legs. There was nothing flat enough in the area to be called a lap.
"Ah, the scullion lad, I see. Galley, is it not? Tender of the cook-fire? What brings you here, pot-urchin? Has one of your spitted carcasses suddenly called out for shriving? The fiery pit has a way of engendering such second thoughts. Hurrum, hurrum!"
It took a moment before Paul realized that the hollow, drum-like sound was actually a laugh.
"I've come asking your help, Bishop Humphrey, true enough."
Galley grabbed Paul's sleeve and tugged him forward.
"This gentleman needed some advice, and I told him, ask Bishop Humphrey. He's the cleverest man in these parts, and here we are."
"Indeed."
The bishop turned his tiny eyes to Paul, then, after an instant's shrewd examination, let them slide away again. He never kept his gaze on anything for very long, which gave his conversation an air of distracted irritation.
"A stranger, eh? A recent immigrant to our humble shire? Or perhaps you are a visitor of a more transient nature, passing through, as it were. A peregrine?"
Paul hesitated. Despite Galley's assurances, he was not entirely comfortable with Humphrey. There was something distant about the man, as though something glassy and brittle stood between him and the outside world. "I am a stranger," he finally admitted. "I'm trying to leave town, but I seem to be caught in some trouble between the red and white factions. Some red soldiers tried to harm me, though I did nothing to them, and there are other men looking for me as well, people I don't want to meet."
"So we need to reckon out the best way for him to get out of the squared,"
Galley finished for him. "The squared?" Paul was confused, but the bishop seemed to understand.
"Ah, yes. Well, what sort of moves do you make?"
He squinted for a moment, then lifted to his eye the monocle which had been dangling on its ribbon down the expanse of his belly. In the bishop's pudgy fingers, it seemed a mere chip of glass.
"It's hard to tell, since you are an outsider like Galley and his tatterdemalions. You have something of the kern about you, yet something of the horseman as well. You might be another thing entirely, of course, but such speculation as to locomotion would be fruitless for me. Like asking a fish whether it would prefer to travel by coach or by velocipede, if you see what I mean. Hurrum, hurrum!"
Paul was lost, but he had been warned that the bishop was prone to talk. He put on an attentive look.
"Bring that over here, boy, the large one,"
Humphrey gestured. Galley sprang to do his bidding, tottering back with a leather-bound book almost as big as he was. With Paul's help, they opened it across the arms of the bishop's chair. Paul was expecting a map, but to his astonishment, the open pages contained nothing but a grid of alternating colored squares, each one full of strange notations and small diagrams.
"Now then, let me see."
The bishop traced his way across the grid with a broad forefinger.
"The most obvious course would seem to be for you to hasten here, catty-cornered to us. But then I have always favored bold diagonals. at least since my investiture. Harum. However, there have been reports of an unpleasantly savage beast in that vicinity, so perhaps that should not be your primary choice. But you are rather hemmed in at the moment. The Queen has a castle not far from here, and I take it you would prefer not to meet with her minions, hm?
He turned a shrewd look on Paul, who shook his head.
I thought not. And the lady herself visits this area here with some frequency. She moves very swiftly, so you would do well not to arrange any long journeys through her favorite territory, even should she prove to be temporarily absent.
The bishop leaned back, making his sturdy chair squeak. He gestured for Galli to take the book away, which the boy groaningly did.
I must cogitate,
the fat man said, and let suety eyelids descend. He was silent for so long that Paul began to think he might have fallen asleep, and took the opportunity to look around the room. Beside the bishop's large collection of handsomely bound books, there were also all manner of curious things lining the walls. Bottles full of dried plants, bones, and even complete skeletons of unfamiliar creatures. Bits of twinkling gemstone. All alone on one shelf stood a huge jar containing living insects, some that looked like crusts of bread, others that resembled nothing so much as puddings. As he watched the strange creatures climbing over each other in the stoppered jar, Paul felt a pang of hunger, which was followed a moment later by a surge of nausea. He was hungry, but not that hungry.
While there is a great deal to be said for the order which Her Scarlet Majesty has brought to us during this extended period of check, the bishop said abruptly, making Paul jump, there is also something to be said for the more laissez-faire attitudes of her predecessor. Therefore, while I myself have excellent relations with our ruler, as I also did with the previous administration, I can understand that you may not be so fortunate.
Humphrey stopped and took a deep draught of air, as though struck breathless by his own admirable rhetoric.
If you wish to avoid the attentions of our Vermilion monarch, I suggest you must take the first alternative I proposed. You can then pass through that square and find yourself directly at the border of our land. The terrible beast said to inhabit the area is doubtless a fantasy of the peasantry, who are famously prone to enliven their dull and rusticated routine with such tales. I will draw you a map. You can be there before sunset. Carpe diem, young man!
He spread his hands contentedly on the arms of his wide chair.
Boldness is all.
While Galli scurried to find the bishop's pen and paper, Paul seized the chance for information. He had been traveling in fog, figuratively and literally, too much of late. What is the name of this place?
Why, it is sometimes referred to as the Eight Squared, at least in the oldest and most learned of tomes. But those of us who have always lived here do not often find cause to refer to it, since we are in the midst of it, rather like a bird, do you see, when asked to define the sky.
Paul hurried to ask him another question. And you were once on good terms with the White King?
Queen, none of us have ever met the somnolent seigneurs of our humble territory. They are rather absentee landlords. No, it is the ladies, bless them both, who have traditionally kept the order within the Eight Squared, while their husbands stayed close to home.
Ah, well, if you were on good terms with the White Queen, but the Red Queen now rules the land, how do you manage to be her friend as well? The bishop looked a trifle annoyed.
Respect, young man. In a single word, that is it. Her Scarlet Majesty relies on my judgment, and I am consulted on things secular as well as superworldly, I might add, and thus I am possessed of a rather unique status.
Paul was not satisfied. But if the Red Queen finds you've helped me, despite the fact that her soldiers might have been looking for me, won't she be annoyed? And if the White Queen ever gains back her power, won't she be furious with you for being so close with her enemy? Now Humphrey seemed truly put out. His sparse eyebrows moved together and tilted sharply downward over the bridge of his nose.
Young man, it does not become you to speak of things beyond your expertise, whatever may be the current fashion. However, in the interest of beginning an education which you obviously sorely need, I will explain something.
He cleared his throat just as Galli reappeared bearing a plume and a large sheet of foolscap. I found them, Bishop.
Yes, that's fine, boy. Now hush.
The bishop briefly fixed his small eyes on Paul,
before allowing them to roam once more.
"I am a respected man, and I dare not, for the good of the land, throw my not inconsiderable weight behind either one faction or the other. For factions are impermanent, even ephemeral, while the rock upon which my bishopric is founded is made of the stuff of eternity. So, if I may create an analogy, my position is that of someone who sits upon a wall. Such a perch might seem dangerous to one who, without my experience and natural sense of balance, gazes up at me from below. In fact, to such a one, a man such as I might seem in imminent peril of a great downfalling. Ah, but the view from up here, from inside here," he tapped his hairless head, "is quite different, I assure you. I am, as it were, made in the perfect shape for wall-sitting. My master has designed me, as it were, to balance permanently between two unacceptable alternatives."
"I see," said Paul, who could think of nothing else to say. The bishop appeared to be in a much better mood after explaining. He rapidly sketched a map, which he handed over with a flourish. Paul thanked him. Then he and Galli left the tiny castle and thumped back across the drawbridge.
"Leave the door open," Bishop Humphrey called after them. "It is too nice a day to miss. And after all, I need fear no one."
Looking down as they thumped across the drawbridge, Paul saw that the moat was very shallow. A man could walk across it and barely get his ankles wet.
"I told you he'd have the answer you needed," Galli said cheerfully.
"Yes," said Paul. "I can see he's the kind of fellow who has answers to things." It took most of the afternoon to walk back. By the time they reached the oyster house, the sun had vanished behind the forest. Paul was looking forward to a chance to sit down and rest his legs. The door swung inward on Galli's first knock.
"Curse those addlepates," the boy said. "Larking about, and they don't remember a thing I've told them. Miyagi! Chesapeake!"
There was no answer but echoes. As Paul followed the boy down the hallway, the sound of their footsteps as stark as drumbeats, he felt a tightening around his heart. There was a strange smell in the air, a sea smell, salty and unpleasantly sweetly sour. The house was very, very quiet. It was silent in the main room as well, but this time no one was hiding. The children lay scattered across the floor, some struck down and left to lie in strange postures like frozen dancers. Others piled carelessly together in the corners, things that had been used and cast away. They had not merely been killed, but violated in some way that Paul could not completely understand. They had been opened up, shucked, and emptied. The sawdust on the floor had clumped in sodden red balls, and still had not sopped up all the red, which gleamed sticky shiny in the failing light. Galli fell to his knees, moaning, his eyes so wide with horror that Paul feared they might burst from his skull. Paul wanted to pull him away, but found he could not move. Written on the wall above one of the largest piles, arching above the pale, spattered arms and legs and blind, wide-mouthed faces, smeared across the boards in sloppy, scarlet letters, was the word Custard. End of Side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.
Side 8. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 231. Chapter 13. Elin's Daughter's Son. Netfeed Interactives. IEN. Hour 4. EUNAM. Backstab. Visual. Kennedy running across a state garden pursued by tornado. V.O. Stabic. Carolus Kennedy. And she, Wendy O'Hara, again try to escape the fortress estate of the mysterious Dr. Methuselah, Moisha Reiner. Jeffrey's six other supporting characters open. Flag to ien.bkstb.cast.
Someone at the door downstairs.
Long Joseph stood nervously in the doorway of her room, unwilling to enter the proximity of illness. Even something as unlikely to be contagious as what he had been told was a breakdown due to stress.
He says his name Gaba or something.
It's Khabu, my friend from the Pali. You can let him in.
He stared for a moment, frowning, then turned and trudged away. He was clearly not happy about answering the door or taking messages for her, but in his own way he was doing his best.
Rini sighed. In any case, she couldn't summon up the energy to be angry. Suspicious and bad-tempered was just her father's way. To his credit, in the days she'd been home, he hadn't expected her to get up and fix him meals. Of course, his own contribution to the household hadn't grown much either. They were both eating a lot of cold cereal and waved menu boxes. She heard the front door opening. She struggled upright in the bed and drank some water, then tried to fluff herself into some appearance of normality. Even if you'd almost died, it was embarrassing to have bed hair. Unlike her father, the bushman came into the sick room with no hesitation. He stopped a few feet away from her, which she guessed was more from some strange sort of respect than anything else. Rini reached out her hand to draw him closer. His fingers were warm and reassuring.
"I am very happy to see you, Rini. I have been worrying about you."
"I'm doing pretty well, actually." She squeezed his hand and released him, then looked around for something for Habu to sit on. The only chair was covered with clothes, but he seemed content to stand.
"I had to fight like hell to get them to send me home from the emergency room, but if I'd gone into hospital, I would have been stuck in quarantine for weeks."
She would also have been close to Stephen, but she knew that would have been a bittersweet proximity at best.
"You are best at home, I think."
He smiled.
"I know that amazing things can be done in a modern hospital, but I am still one of my people. I would become even more sick if I had to stay in such a place."
Rini looked up. Her father was back in the doorway, staring at Habu. Long Joseph had a very strange expression on his face. When he saw Rini, it changed to something like embarrassment.
"I'm going over to see Walter."
He showed her his hat as proof. He took a few steps away, then turned.
"You be all right?"
"I'm not going to die while you're gone, if that's what you mean."
She saw the closing up of his face and regretted her words.
"I'll be fine, Papa. Don't you and Walter drink too much."
Her father had been looking at Habu again, but he scowled at Rini. It was not particularly unpleasant, more of a general-purpose scowl.
"Don't you worry about what I'm getting up to, girl."
Habu was still standing patiently when the door closed behind Long Joseph, eyes bright in his small, solemn face. Rini patted the edge of the bed.
"Please sit down. You're making me nervous. I'm sorry we couldn't talk before, but the drugs I've been taking make me sleep a lot."
"But you are better now?" He scrutinized her face.
"You look healthy in your spirit to me. When we first came back from that place, I was very frightened for you."
"It was an arrhythmia, not really a full-fledged heart attack. In fact, I'm feeling enough better that I'm beginning to get really angry.
I saw them, Habu, the bastards who run that place. I saw what they do in that club. I still don't have the slightest idea why. But if we weren't both this close..."
She held up her fingers.
"To having the same thing happen as Stephen and who knows how many others, I'll eat my hat."
Habu stared at her, confused. Rini laughed.
"Sorry. That's an expression that means I'm certain I'm right. Haven't you heard it before?"
The bushman shook his head.
"No, but I am learning more all the time, learning to think almost in this language. Sometimes I wonder what I am losing."
He finally sat down. He was so light, Rini barely felt the mattress give.
"What do we do now, Rini? If what you say is true, these are bad people, doing very bad things. Do we tell the police or the government?"
"That's one of the reasons I wanted to see you, to show you something." She reached down behind her pillows, feeling for her pad. It took her some moments to pull it from the gap between the mattress and the wall where it had been wedged. She was dismayed by how weak she still felt. Even the small effort made her feel short of breath.
"Did you bring the goggles? It's so much slower trying to work on a flat screen."
Habu produced the cases stamped with the Polytechnic's logo. Rini took out both sets. Neither, much larger than a pair of sunglasses, found a Y-connector in the tangle of cables beside her, and jacked both the goggle cable and a pair of squeezers into her pad. When she handed one pair of goggles to Habu, he did not immediately take them.
"What's wrong?"
He shook his head slowly.
"I was lost, Rini. I failed you when we were in that place." "We're not going anywhere near there. Besides, this is just optical display and sound anyway, not full wraparound. We are just going to go visit the Poly's info banks and a few other subnets. There's nothing to be afraid of." "It is not so much fear that holds me back, although I would be a liar if I said I was not frightened. But there is more. There are things I need to tell you, Rini. Things about what happened to me in that place."
She paused, not wanting to push him.
Despite his facility, she reminded herself, he was still very new to this, new to everything she took for granted, in fact.
I have things I need to show you, too. I promise you it will be no worse than working in the lab at the school. Afterward, I very much want to hear what you have to say.
She offered the goggles again, and this time Habu accepted them. The empty gray quickly became the ordered polygons of her personal system, a simple array resembling a home office, far less sophisticated than what she had available at the poly. She had customized it with a few pictures on the wall and a tank of tropical fish. But otherwise it was a coldly functional environment, a system for someone who was always in a hurry. She couldn't see herself changing it any time soon.
We were in that place for what, 3 hours? Four?
As she palpated the squeezers, one of the polygons became a window. After a moment, the Polytechnic's logo and advisory warning appeared. Rini keyed in her access code, and immediately the library environment sprang into detailed existence.
"Bear with me," she said. "I'm used to doing my work here with some kind of freehand capabilities, but today we're stuck with these squeezer things, which are pretty basic."
It was strange to be moving through such a familiar and realistic environment, but not being able to react directly to anything. When she wanted to manipulate one of the symbolic objects, instead of reaching out toward it, she had to think about the quite different things needed to key in a direction.
"This is what I wanted you to see,"
she said when she'd finally opened the information window she wanted.
"The Polly's records for that day."
Lines of numbers rolled rapidly upward in front of them.
"Here's the harness room prefix. All the connections. There we are signing in. That's my access code, right?"
"I see it." Habu's voice was steady but distant.
"Well, scan this. That's our usage record. No connection except to the in-house school system."
"I don't understand."
"It means that according to this, we never logged onto the net. Never entered the commercial node called Mr. J's at all. Everything we experienced, the pool, that sea monster, that huge main room, none of it happened. That's what the Polly's records say, anyway."
"I am confused, Rini. Perhaps I am still not as wise about these things as I believed myself to be. How could there be no record?"
"I don't know."
Rini played the squeezers. Inside the goggle universe, the Polly's records disappeared, and another window opened up.
"Look at this. My own personal accounts, even the ones I set up just for this, are zeroed. None of the connection time was charged to me. To the school. Anywhere. There's not a single record of what we did. Nothing."
She took a breath, reminding herself to stay calm. She still got a little dizzy now and then, but was feeling stronger every day, which made the whole thing even more frustrating.
"If we can't find the records, we can't very well make a complaint, can we? You can just imagine what the reaction of the authorities would be.
That's a very serious charge, Ms. Sulawayo, especially since you've apparently never used the node in question.
It would be useless."
"I wish I could make some suggestion, Rini. I wish there was some help I could give, but this is beyond my very young knowledge."
"You can help. You can help me try to find out what happened. I don't have much stamina, and I get tired if I have to stare at anything too long. But if you can be my eyes, we can try a few things I haven't had a chance to do yet. I'm not giving up that easily. Those bastards have hurt my brother, and they damn near got you and me, too."
Rini was leaning back against the pillows. She'd taken her medicine, and as usual, it was making her sleepy. Habu was sitting cross-legged on the floor, his eyes hidden by the goggles, his fingers moving with surprising fluency on the squeezer keys.
"There is nothing like what you describe," he said,
breaking a long silence.
"No loops, no repetitions. All the loose ends are, as you would say, tied up."
"Shit."
She closed her eyes again, trying to think of another way through the problem. Someone had wiped out all record of what she and Habu had done, then fabricated a new one and inserted it seamlessly into place. The time they had spent in the club, all of it, was now as insubstantial and unprovable as a dream.
"The thing that frightens me is not just that they've managed to do that, but the fact that they tracked back all my aliases and wiped them, too. There shouldn't be any way in hell they could do that."
Habu was still moving through the data world. The goggles looked like insect eyes on his narrow face.
"But if they have found these false selves you constructed, can they not trace them back to you?"
"Yesterday I would have said not in a million years, but suddenly I'm not so sure. If they know it was someone at the poly,
they wouldn't have much trouble narrowing it down without even getting into internal records.
She bit her lip, wondering. It was not a pleasant thought.
She somehow doubted that the people who ran Mr. J's would limit themselves to the kind of intimidation that came in a solicitor's letter. I kept them as far from me as I could when I was setting up the aliases, went in through public notes, everything I could think of. I never believed they could track me straight back to the Poly.
Habu made a sudden noise, a small click of surprise. Rini sat up.
What? There is something...
He paused, and his fingers moved swiftly.
There is something here. What does it mean when an orange light flashes in your office? It is blinking like a lightning beetle. It just began.
That's the antivirals kicking in.
Rini leaned over, ignoring the moment of lightheadedness, and picked the other pair of goggles up from the floor. She pulled the Y-connector tight between her and Habu.
Someone's trying to get into my system, maybe.
A shiver of unease moved through her. Had they tracked her already?
Who were these people?
She was in the system's basic VR representation again, the three-dimensional office. A small vermilion dot was blinking on and off, a smoldering glow like a coal from a braai. She leaned and groped blindly across Habu's knee, then tapped a couple of keys. Inside the virtual space, the dot of light exploded into a welter of symbols and text which filled much of the office.
Whatever it is, it's already in the system, but it's still dormant, probably a virus.
She was angry that her system had been penetrated, and perhaps hopelessly corrupted, but at the same time it seemed an oddly muted response from the kind of people who owned such a club. She set her phage gear in search of the intruding code. It didn't have to hunt very long.
What in hell?
Habu sensed her puzzlement.
What is wrong, Rini? That's not supposed to be there.
Hanging in virtual space before them, rendered much more realistically than the plainer office furniture, was a translucent, yellow-glinting, faceted object.
It looks like a yellow diamond.
An image as tenuous as a dream floated up to her. A pure white shape. An empty person made of light. Then it was gone again.
Is it the computer sickness? Is it something those people have sent? I don't know. I think I recall something about it from just before we went offline, but it's all very confused. I don't remember much of what happened after I went back to the cave to get you.
The yellow gem hung before her, staring back like an emotionless golden eye.
I really must talk to you, Rini.
Habu sounded unhappy.
I must tell you about what happened to me there. Not now.
She quickly threw her analyticals at the gem, or at what the gem represented. When the results came back a few moments later, surrounding the foreign object like a system of tiny text planets orbiting a diamond-edged sun, she whistled between her teeth in surprise.
It's code, but it's been compacted until it's tight as a drum. There's an amazing amount of information packed in there. If it is some kind of destructive virus, it's got enough information to rewrite a system much bigger than mine.
What are you going to do? Rini didn't answer him for several long moments as she hastily checked back through her earlier connections.
Wherever it came from, it's attached itself to my system now, but I don't see any trace of it remaining on my part of the Polytechnic's net, which is just as well. God, the pad is bulging. I hardly have any memory left.
She cut her connection to the school.
I don't think I can even activate this thing on my little system here, so maybe it's effectively neutralized. Although I can't imagine why someone would set up a virus that downloads itself to a system too small for it to operate. For that matter, I can't imagine why anyone would make a virus that big. It's like trying to use an elephant to do surveillance in a phone booth.
She turned off her system and removed the goggles, then slumped back on her bed. Small spots of yellow light like the diamond's smaller cousins jittered before her eyes. Habu took off his own goggles and looked at the pad with suspicion, as though something unpleasant might crawl out of it. He then turned his worried look onto her.
You look pale. I will pour you some water. I have to find a system that's powerful enough to let the thing activate,
Rini said, thinking out loud.
But that's not connected to any other system. Something big and isolated. Sterile. I could probably set that up in one of the labs at the Poly, but I'd have to answer a lot of questions.
Habu carefully handed her a glass.
Should you not destroy it? If it is something that those people made, the people of that terrible place, it must be a dangerous thing. But if it came from the club, it's the only proof we've got that we were there. Even more important, it's code, and people who write high-level code have their own style, just like flick directors or artists. If we can figure out who writes the gear for Mr. J's dirty side, well, it's a place to start anyway.
She drained the glass in two long swallows, amazed at how thirsty she was.
I'm not going to give up just because they frightened me.
She let herself slump back against the pillows.
I'm not giving up.
Habu still sat cross-legged on the floor. So how will you do this if you do not use the school? He sounded almost mournful, far more so than was appropriate for what he'd said, as though he were making small talk while saying goodbye to someone he did not expect to see again.
I'm thinking. I have a couple of ideas, but I need to let them cook. The bushman was quiet,
staring at the floor. At last he looked up.
His eyes were troubled,
his forehead wrinkled.
Rini suddenly realized that a quite uncharacteristic gloom had been hanging over him since he had arrived. You said you wanted to talk to me about what happened.
He nodded his head.
I am very confused, Rini, and I need to speak. You are my friend. You have saved my life, I think. And you saved mine. And I know that for certain. If you had waited too long before getting help for me,
it was not hard to see that your spirit was very weak, that you were very ill. He shrugged as though embarrassed.
So talk to me. Tell me why your spirit is weak, if that's what is wrong.
He nodded, his expression solemn.
Since we came back from that place, I do not hear the sun ringing. That is what my people say. When you can no longer hear the sound the sun makes, your spirit is in danger. I have felt that way many days now. First, I must tell you things about me you do not know, some of the story that is my life. I told you that my father is dead, that my mother and my sisters live with my people. You know that I have been to city schools. I am of my people, but I also have the language, the ideas of city people. Sometimes these things feel like a poison inside of me, something cold that might stop my heart.
He stopped, drawing a deep, ragged breath. Whatever he was about to tell clearly pained him. Rini found that she was clenching her fists tightly, as though watching someone she loved perform a dangerous feat in a high place.
There are very few of my people left,
he began.
The old blood is mostly gone. We have married the taller people, or sometimes our women have been taken against their wishes. But there are fewer and fewer who look like me. There are fewer still who live in the old way, even those who are of the true bushman kind, of the pure blood, are almost all raising sheep or working in cattle stations along the edges of the Kalahari, or in the Okavango Delta. That was my mother's family, a Delta family. They had sheep, a few goats. They took fish from the Delta and traded in the nearest town for things that they felt they needed, things our ancestors would have laughed at. How they would have laughed! Radios. Someone even had an old television that worked on batteries. What are those things but the voices of the white man, and the black man who lives like the white man? Our ancestors would not have understood. The voices of the city drown out the sounds of the life my people once lived, just as they make it hard to hear the ringing of the sun. So my mother's family lived a life like many of Africa's poor black people, haunting the outside places of what had been their own lands. The whites do not rule in Africa now. At least they no longer sit in the offices of the government. But the things they brought here rule Africa in their place. This you know, even living in the city.
Rini nodded.
I know. But there are still some of our people who live the old way, the way of the early races, the way of Mantis and Porcupine and Quamanga the Rainbow. My father and his people lived this way. They were hunters, traveling in the desert where neither the white man nor the black man go, following the lightning, the rains, and the antelope herds. They still lived the life that my people have lived since the very first days of creation, but only because there is nothing the city folk want from the desert. I learned in school that there are still a few such places left in this world, a few places where no radios play, where no rolling wheels leave their tracks. But these places are shrinking away, like water spilled on a flat rock that dries beneath the sun. But the only way my father's people could keep their life and hold on to the old ways was to stay far away from everyone, even those of our blood who had left the desert and the sacred hills. Once all Africa was ours, and we roamed it with the other first peoples, with the eland and the lion, the springbok and the baboon. We call baboons the people who sit on their heels, and all the others, But the last remnants of our kind can live only by hiding. To them, the city world is true poison. They cannot survive its touch. Many years ago now, before you or I were born, a terrible drought began. It hurt all the land, but most of all the dry places, the places where only my father's people lived. It lasted 3 full years. The great springbok herds deserted the land, the kudu and the hartebeest too. They all died or moved away, and my father's family suffered. Even the sipping wells, the places where only the bushmen can find water, ran dry. The old people had already given themselves up to the desert, that the younger ones might live. But now the young and strong were dying also. The children already born were weak and sickly, and no new children had come. Since in a time of great drought, our women are no longer fertile. My father was a hunter. In the early prime of his life, he traveled far across the desert, walking for days in search of anything that might help keep his family, his brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, alive. But each time he went out, he had to go farther in search of game, and each time there was less food to keep him alive as he hunted. The ostrich shells in which my people carry water were always nearly empty. The other hunters had no better luck, and the women worked all day long, every day, digging for any roots that might have survived the terrible drought, collecting what few insects remained so that the children would have something to eat. At night, they all prayed that the rains would finally come back. They had no happiness. They did not sing. And after a while, they did not even tell stories. The misery was so great that some of my father's family suspected that the rain had finally left the earth and gone away forever, to some other place, that life itself was ending. One day, when my father was on a hunting trip and had already been away from his people for 7 days, he saw an impossible vision, a great eland, the most wonderful of all creatures, standing at the edge of a desert pan, nibbling at the bark of a thorn tree, an eland he knew would provide days of food for his family, and even the water in the grass remaining in its stomach would help to keep the children alive a little longer. But he knew it was also a strange thing to see this single, solitary beast. The eland does not travel in vast herds like the other antelope, but where he goes, his family goes, just as with our own people. Also, this eland was not sick. Its ribs did not show, despite the terrible drought. He could not help wondering if perhaps this animal was a special gift from Grandfather Mantis, who had made the very first eland from the leather of Quamanga's sandal. As he wondered, the eland saw him and darted away. My father gave chase. All of one day he followed the eland, and when at last it stopped to rest, he crept as close as he could, then daubed an arrow with his strongest poison, and let it fly. He saw the arrow strike before the eland ran away. When he went to the place it had been, the arrow was not there, so his heart was full. He had struck what he shot at. He began to track it, waiting for the poison to take effect. But the eland did not slow, or show any sign of weakness. All the next day he tracked it, but never came close enough to shoot another arrow. The eland moved quickly. My father's ostrich shells were empty, and there was no more dried meat in his pack, but he had no time to search for water or hunt for food. 2 more days he tracked the animal across the sands. By hot sun and cold moon, the eland ran ever southeast, toward the place where the desert ended in what had been a great swamp around a river delta. My father had never in his life been half so close to the Okavango. His people, who had once traveled 1,000 miles every season, now kept to the most inaccessible inner reaches of the desert for their own safety. But he had become a little mad with hunger and weariness and fear, or perhaps a spirit was in him. He was determined that he would catch the eland. He now felt sure that it was a gift from Mantis, and that if he brought it back to his people, the rains would come. At last, on the 4th day after he had shot at the eland, he stumbled across the fringes of the desert, through the hills, into the outer edges of the Okavango swamp. But of course the swamp had also dried in the great drought, and so he found nothing but cracked mud and dead trees. But still he saw the eland running before him, as faint as a dream, and saw its track in the dust. So he went on. He walked all night through that unfamiliar place, the bones of crocodiles and fish showing white beneath the moon. My father's people lived in the old way. They knew every rock and mound of sand, every tree and thorn bush of the desert, in the way that city people know the habits of their children, or the furnishings of their houses. But now he was in a place that he did not know, and chasing a great eland that he believed was a spirit. He was weak and afraid, but he was a hunter, and his people were in terrible need. He prayed to the grandmother stars for wisdom, when the morning star, who is the greatest hunter of all, at last appeared in the sky. My father prayed to him as well. "Make my heart as your heart," he asked the star. He was begging for the courage to survive, for he had grown very weak. As the sun rose up into the sky and began to burn the land again, my father saw the shape of the eland beside a stream of running water. The sight of so much water, and the spirit beast so close at last, made my father's head hurt, and so he fell to the ground. He crawled toward the eland, but his arms and legs grew weak, and he could not crawl any farther. But as his senses fled from him, he saw that the eland had become a beautiful girl, a girl of our people, but with an unfamiliar face. It was my mother, who had gotten up early in the morning to walk to the water. The drought meant that even the great river delta was nearly dry, and she and her family had to travel a long way from their tiny village beside the road to draw water. My mother saw this hunter come from the desert and fall down in a swoon at her feet, and she saw that he was dying. She gave him to drink. He emptied her jug, then nearly drank the little stream dry. When he could walk, she took him back to her family. The older ones still spoke his language. While my mother's parents fed him, the grandparents asked him many questions, clucking to themselves in wonder at seeing a man of their own early memories. He ate, but did not say much. Although these people looked much like him, their ways were strange, but he hardly noticed what they did. He had eyes only for my mother. She, who had never seen a man of the old ways, had eyes only for him. He could not stay. He had lost the eland, but he would at least take water back to his family and people. He was also uneasy with the strangers, with their box that spoke, with their strange clothes and strange language. My mother, who did not like or respect her own father because he beat her, ran away with my father, preferring to go to his people than to remain with her own. Although he did not urge her to leave her family, he was very happy when she came with him, for she was beautiful in his eye from their first meeting. He called her Eland's daughter, and they laughed together, although at first they could not understand each other's speech. When at last, after a journey of many days, they found his people again, the rest of his family was amazed by his story, and welcomed her, and made much of her. That night, thunder rang out over the desert, and lightning walked. The rains had come back. The drought was ended. Habu fell silent. Rini waited as long as she could before speaking. "And then what happened?" He looked up, a small, sad smile playing about his lips. "Am I not tiring you with this long story, Rini? It is only my story, the story of how I came to be and how I came here."
"Tiring me? It's wonderful, like a fairy tale."
The smile flickered. "I stopped, because that was the happiest moment for them, I think, when the rains came. My father's family thought he had brought back the eland's daughter in truth, that he had brought luck back to them. But if I go on, the story grows more sad."
"If you want to tell me, I want to listen, Habu. Please."
"So," he spread his hands, "for a time after that, things were good. With the rain's return came the animals, and soon things were growing again. Trees were making new leaves, flowers were springing up. Even the bees returned and began to make their wonderful honey, and hide it away in the rocks. This was truly a sign that life was strong in that place. There is nothing the bushmen like so much as honey, and that is why we love the little bird called the honey guide. So things were good. Soon after, my mother and father conceived a child. That was me, and they named me Habu, which means dream. The bushmen believed that life is a dream, which itself is dreaming us, and my parents wanted to mark the good fortune that the dream had sent them. Others in the family also bore children, so my first few years were spent among companions of my own age. Then a terrible thing happened. My father and his nephew were out hunting. It had been a successful day. They had killed a fine big hartebeest. They were happy, because they knew that there would be a feast when they returned, and that the meat would feed their families well for several days. On their way back, they came across a jeep. They had heard of such things, but had never seen one before, and at first they were reluctant to go near it. But the men in it, three black men and one white, all tall, all dressed in city clothes, were clearly in danger. They had the look of people who would die soon if they did not get water. So my father and his nephew went to them and helped them. These men were desert scientists from one of the universities. I would guess that they were geologists, searching for oil or something else of value to city people. Their jeep had been struck by lightning, so that both engine and radio were useless. Without help, they would doubtless have died. My father and his nephew led them to the outskirts of the desert, to a small trading village. This they would not have dared to do, except that my father remembered he had left the desert once before without harm. My father planned to take them to the edge of the town and send them on their way. But as they all walked, very slowly, since that was as fast as the city folk could go, another jeep came. This one belonged to government rangers, and although they used their radio to summon help for the men my father had rescued, they also arrested my father and his nephew for having killed a hartebeest. The hartebeest, you see, is protected by the government. The bushman is not.
The uncharacteristic bitterness in his words made Rini flinch.
They arrested them? After they just saved those men? That's horrible.
Khabu nodded.
The scientists argued against it, but the rangers were the kind of men who fear that they will get in trouble if they are seen to let some small thing pass. So they arrested my father and his relative and took them away, just like that. They even took the hartebeest as evidence. By the time my father and his nephew reached the town, it was a rotting carcass, unfit to eat, and was thrown away. The scientists were so ashamed that they borrowed another vehicle and went to tell my father's people what had happened. They did not find them, but they found another group of bushmen, and soon my mother and the rest of the family heard what had happened. My mother, who, if she had not lived in the city world, at least knew something of it, determined that she would go and argue with the government, which she thought of as a wise man with a white beard in a big village, and tell them they must let my father go. Although the rest of the family warned her not to do it, she took me and set out for the town. But, of course, my father had already been sent on to the city, far away, and by the time my mother could make her way there, he had already been convicted and sentenced for poaching. Both he and my cousin were put in prison, caged with men who had committed terrible crimes, who had shot their own families dead, had tortured and killed children or old people. Every day my mother went to beg for my father's freedom, taking me with her, and every day she was driven away from the court, and later the prison, with harsh words and blows. She found us a shack on the edge of the city, two walls of plywood and a piece of tin for a roof, and she scavenged in the rubbish heaps for food and clothing with the other poor people, determined that she would not leave until my father was free. I cannot even imagine what it felt like for her. I was so young that I did not really understand. Even now I have only the faintest memories of that time, a vision of the bright lights of a truck shining through the cracks between the boards, the sound of people arguing and singing loudly in other shacks. But it must have been a terrible time for her, alone and so far from her people. She would not give up. She was certain that if she could only find the right man, the real government, as she thought of it, then eventually the mistake would be made right, and my father allowed to go free. My father, who had even less knowledge of the city world than she, grew sick. After a few visits, he was not allowed to see my mother anymore, although she continued to go to the prison every day. My father did not even know she was still in the city, only a few hundred yards from him. He and his nephew lost their happiness, lost their stories. Their spirits became very weak, and they stopped eating. Soon, after only a few months in the prison, my father died. His nephew lasted longer. I am told that he was killed in a fight some months later. Oh, Khabu, how terrible!
He raised his hand, as if Rini's cry of sympathy was a gift he could not accept.
My mother could not even take my father's body back to the desert. He was buried instead in a cemetery beside the shantytown.
My mother hung his ostrich shell beads on a wooden stick for a marker. I have gone there, but I could not find his grave. My mother took me and started the long trip back.
she could not bear to go to the desert again, to the place that meant my father to her, so she stayed with her own family instead, and that is where I was raised. Before too many more years, she found another man, a good man. He was bushman, but his people had left the desert long ago. He did not know the old ways, and barely spoke the language. He and my mother had two daughters, my sisters. We were all sent to school. My mother demanded that we learn the city ways, so that we could protect ourselves, as my father could not do. My mother did not give up all contact with my father's people. When some of the farther-ranging bushmen came to the village to trade, my mother sent back messages. One day, when I was perhaps 10 years old, my uncle came out of the desert. With my mother's blessing, he took me to meet my relations. I will not tell you the story of the years I spent with them. I learned much, both of my father and the world in which he had lived. I grew to love them, and also to fear for them. Even at that young age I could see that their way of life was dwindling away. They knew it themselves. I often think that although they never told me so, that is not my people's way, they hoped that through me they would save something of the wisdom of Grandfather Mantis, of the old ways, like a man lost on an island who writes a letter and puts it in a bottle. I think they meant to send me back to the city world with something of our people saved inside me. Khabu hung his head. And the first of my great shames is that for many years after I returned to my mother's village, I thought no more of it. No, that is not true, for I thought of my time with my father's people often, and always will. But I thought little of the fact that they would be gone some day, that almost nothing would be left of the old world. I was young, and saw life as something limitless. I was eager to learn everything, and afraid of nothing. The prospect of the city world and all its wonders seemed far more intriguing than life in the bush. I worked hard in the small school, and a man who was important in the village took interest in me. He told a group called the Circle about me. They are people from all over the world who are interested in what city folk call aboriginal cultures. With their help, I was able to gain a position at a school in the same city where my father died. A good school. My mother feared for me, but in her wisdom she let me go. At least, I think it was wisdom. So I studied, and learned of other kinds of life besides that led by my people. I became familiar with things that are as ordinary to you as water and air, but to me were at first strange and almost magical. Electric light, wall screens, plumbing. I learned about the science of the folk who had invented these things, and learned some of the history of the black and white peoples as well. But in all the books, all the Netflix, there was almost nothing about my own people. Always I returned to my mother's family when school was ended for the season to help with the sheep and set out the nets for fish. Fewer and fewer of those living in the old way came to the village to trade. As the years passed, I began to wonder what had happened to my father's people. Did they still live in the desert? Did my uncle and his brothers still dance the eland dance when they had killed one of the great beasts? Did my aunt and her sisters still sing songs about how the earth is lonely for the rain? I decided that I would go and see them again. And here is my second shame. Even though it had been a good year, even though the rains had been plentiful, and the desert was friendly and full of life, I almost died while searching for them. I had forgotten much of what they had taught me. I was like a man who grows old and loses his vision, loses his hearing. The desert and the dry hills kept secrets from me. I survived, but only barely, after much thirst and hunger. It was a long time until I could feel the rhythm of life the way my father's family had taught me, before I could feel again the ticking in my breast that told me game was near, smell the places where water lay close beneath the sand. I slowly found the old ways, but I did not find my father's family or any other free bushman. At last I went to the sacred places, the hills where the people painted on the rocks, but there was no sign of recent habitation. Then I truly feared for my relations. Every year they had gone there to show their respect for the spirits of the first people, but they had not come for a long time. My father's people were gone. Perhaps they are all dead. I left the desert, but something in me had changed forever. I made a promise to myself that the life of my people would not simply disappear, that the stories of Mongoose and Porcupine and the Morning Star would not be forgotten. The old ways would not be swept away by the sand as the wind blows away a man's footprints after he has died. Whatever must be done to save something of them, I would do it. To accomplish this, I would learn the science of the city people, which I then believed could do anything. Again, the people in the circle were generous, and with their help I came to Durban to study how the city people make worlds for themselves. For that is what I wish to do, Rini. What I must do. I must make the world of my people again. The world of the early race. It will never exist again in our time, on our earth. But it should not be lost forever. Khabu fell silent, rocking back and forth. His eyes were dry, but his pain was very clear.
But I think that's a wonderful thing,
Rini said at last. If her friend was not crying, she was.
I think that's the best argument for VR I've ever heard. Why are you so unhappy now, when you have learned so much, when you're so much nearer to your goal?
Because when I was in that terrible place with you, while you were struggling to save my life, I went away in my thoughts to another world. That is shameful, that I left you behind, but I could not help it. So that is not what makes me sad.
He stared at her, and now she saw the fear again.
I went to the place of the first people. I do not know how or why, but while you were experiencing all the things that you told to me in the emergency room, I was in another place. I saw sweet Grandfather Mantis riding between the horns of his hartebeest. His wife, Kauru, was there, and his two sons, Quamanga and Mongoose. But the one who spoke to me was Porcupine, his beloved daughter. She told me that even the place beyond the world, the place of the first people, was in danger. Before the honey guide appeared to lead me back, she told me that soon the place where we were would become a great emptiness, that just as this city world in which you and I sit had gradually overwhelmed my people in their desert, so the first people were being overwhelmed. If that is so, then it will not matter if I build my people's world again, Rini. If the first people are driven from their place beyond this earth, then anything I make will only be an empty shell, a beetle's hollow casing left behind when the beetle has died. I do not want to use your science simply to make a museum, Rini, a place for city folk to see what was once alive. Do you understand? I want to make a home where something of my people will live forever. If the home of the first people disappears, then the dream that is dreaming us will dream us no more. The whole life of my people, since the very dawn of things, will be nothing but footprints vanishing under the wind. And that is why I can no longer hear the sun ringing.
They sat together in silence for a while. Rini poured herself another glass of water and offered some to Khabu, but he shook his head. She could not understand what he was saying, and a part of her was uncomfortable, as she was when her Christian colleagues spoke of heaven, or the Muslims spoke of the Prophet's miracles. But there was no ignoring the Bushman's deep unhappiness.
I do not understand exactly what you mean, but I'm trying.
She reached out and lifted his unresisting hand, squeezing his dry fingers in hers.
As you have helped me try to help Stephen, I'll do my best to help you. Just tell me what I can do. You're my friend, Khabu.
He smiled for the first time since he had arrived.
And you are my good friend, Rini. I do not know what I must do. I have been thinking and thinking.
He gently retrieved his hand and rubbed his eyes, his weariness very evident.
But we also have your questions to answer. So many questions the two of us have. What are we to do about the yellow diamond? That dangerous thing?
Rini yawned, hugely and, to her, embarrassingly.
I think I may know someone who can help us, but I'm too tired to deal with it now. After I get some sleep, I'll call her.
Then sleep. I will stay until your father returns.
She told him it was not necessary, but it was like arguing with a cat.
I will give you privacy.
Khabu stood up smoothly, a single motion.
I will sit in your other room and think.
Smiling again, he backed out the door and pulled it closed behind him. Rini lay for a long time thinking of the strange places they had both visited, places only linked because they had both been conceived in the human mind, or so she believed. But it was hard to hold firmly to that belief when watching the deep longing and expression of loss on Khabu's serious, intelligent face. She woke up, startled by the tall, dark figure bending over her. Her father took a hurried step back, as though he had been caught doing something bad.
It's only me, girl. Just checking you are all right.
I'm fine. I took my medicine. Is Khabu here?
He shook his head. She could smell the beer on his breath.
but he seemed relatively steady on his feet.
He gone home. What, you making him line up now?
She stared at him in puzzlement.
Another man sitting in a car out in front when I got home. Big man. Beard. He drove off when I walked up.
Rini felt a swift pang of fear.
A white man?
Her father laughed.
Round here? Nah, he was black as me. Somebody for one of the other places, probably. Or a robber. You keep that chain on the door when I'm not around.
She smiled.
Yes, Papa.
It was rare to see him so concerned.
I'll see if there's something to eat.
He hesitated in the doorway, then turned.
That friend of yours. He's one of the small people.
Yes, he's a bushman, from the Okavango Delta.
There was a strange look in her father's eye, a small fire of memory.
They the oldest folk, you know. They were here even before the black man came. Before the Xhosa, the Zulu, any of them.
She nodded, intrigued by the faraway sound of his voice.
I never thought I'd see one of his kind again. The small people. Never thought I'd see any more.
He went out, the distracted expression still on his face. He shut the door quietly. Chapter 14. His Master's Voice. Netfeed, News. Merowe to face war crimes trial. Visual, Merowe surrendering to UN General Ram Chagra. V.O.
Hassan Merowe, the ousted president of the Nubian Republic, will face a UN tribunal for war crimes.
Visual. UN soldiers excavating mass graves outside Khartoum.
As many as 1 million people are thought to have died during the 10 years of Merowe's rule, one of the bloodiest in the history of northeastern Africa.
Visual. Merowe's attorney, Mohammed al-Rashad.
Rashad. President Merowe is not afraid to stand before other world leaders. My client single-handedly built our nation from the smoldering ruins of Sudan. These people all know that a leader must sometimes take a firm stand during times of chaos. And if they claim they would have done differently, then they are hypocrites.
A neon red line crawled at the edge of his vision, as though one of his own ocular capillaries had suddenly become visible. The line wriggled and turned on itself, branching and then rebranching as the expert system which it symbolized did its work. Dredd smiled. Bena Ibena were not trusting his promises on security. They wanted to know his virtual office as well as they knew their own. Not that he would have expected anything different. In fact, despite some successful past partnerships, he would have had serious doubts about hiring them again if they had taken him at his word. Confident, cocky, lazy, dead. It was the old man's mantra, and a good one, even if Dredd sometimes drew the lines in different places than the old man would. Still, he was alive, and in his kind of business, that was the only measurement of success. There were no failures who were merely poor. Of course, the old man had something to show for his greater caution. He had been alive longer than his hired gun. A lot longer. Dredd augmented the field of abstract color outside the office's single window, then returned his own attention to the virtual white wall as the Baina's gear finished checking the security of his node. When it had satisfied itself, it disconnected, the red line vanishing from Dredd's own monitor program, and the Baina twins immediately snapped in. They appeared as two identical but almost featureless objects, seated side by side on the far side of the table like a pair of headstones. The Baina sisters disdained high-quality sims for personal meetings, and no doubt regarded Dredd's own expensive replication as a meaningless and flashy example of excess. He enjoyed the prospect of their irritation. Noting the tics of other professionals, and even of his victims, was the closest he ever came to the fondness for the habits of friends that enlivened the existence of more mundane people. Welcome, ladies. He gestured to the simulated black marble table and the Yixing stoneware tea service, so important for doing even virtual business with Pacific Rim clients that Dredd had made it a permanent part of his office environment.
Can I offer you anything?
He could almost feel the annoyance that emanated from the twin shapes.
We do not waste our net time on amateur theatricals, one of them said.
His satisfaction increased. They were annoyed enough not to hide it. First move to him.
We are here to deal, said the other faceless shape.
He could never remember their names. Shisha and Nusha, something like that. Elfin Indio names quite out of character with their real selves.
first given to them when they were the child stars of a Sao Paulo brothel. Not that it mattered whether he remembered or not. The two operated so much as a single entity that either would answer questions addressed to the other. The Baena sisters considered names almost as much of a sentimental indulgence as realistic sims. "Then we'll deal," he said cheerfully. "You reviewed the prospectus, of course?" More irritation, revealed in the slight pause before reply.
"We have. It can be done."
"It will not be easy," he thought the second had spoken. But they used the same digitized voice, so it was difficult to tell. The sisters had an effective act. They seemed to be one mind inhabiting two bodies.
"What if it really is only one person?" he suddenly wondered. "I've certainly never seen more than one of them at a time in R.L. What if the whole deadly twin thing is just a marketing gimmick?"
Dredd put aside the interesting thought for later.
"We are prepared to pay 350,000 Swiss credits, plus approved expenses."
"That is unacceptable."
Dredd raised an eyebrow, knowing his sim would mimic the effect exactly.
"Then it seems we'll have to find another contracting agency."
The Baenas regarded him for a moment, blank as two stones.
"The job you wish done is only technically within the civil sector. Because of the importance of the object you plan to remove, there would be many repercussions from the national government. Loss of the object would in fact have worldwide impact. This means that any contractors would have to prepare a greater degree of protection than is usual."
He wondered how much of their unaccented English was voice filters. It was not hard to imagine a pair of 22-year-old women, if his information on them could be trusted, purposefully shedding their accents along with everything else they had jettisoned on their way to becoming what they were. He decided to poke them a bit.
"What you're saying is, this not really a civilian job, but a political assassination."
There was a long moment's silence. Mockingly, Dredd brought up the background music to fill it. When the first sister spoke, her voice was as flat and inflectionless as before.
"That is correct, and you know it."
"So you think it's worth more than 350,000 Swiss credits?"
"We will not waste your time. We do not want more money. In fact, if you sweeten the job for us with something else, we will ask only 100,000 Swiss credits, most of which we will need for post-action protection and a cooling-off period."
Again the eyebrow lifted.
"And what is this something else?"
The second of the two shapeless figures laid spatulate hands on the tabletop.
"We have heard that your principal has access to certain biological products, a large source of them in our own hemisphere."
Dredd sat forward. He felt something tightening at his temples.
"My principal? I'm the only person you deal with on this contract. You're on very dangerous ground."
"Nevertheless, it is known you do a great deal of work for a certain group. Whether they are the ultimate source of this contract or not, they have something we want."
"We wish to start a side business," said the other sister.
"Something less strenuous for our old age than our current occupation. We think that wholesaling these biological products would be ideal, and we seek a way into the business. Your principal can grant us that. We seek a franchise, not a rivalry."
Dredd considered. The old man and his friends, despite the immense influence they wielded, were certainly the object of many rumors. The Baenas traveled in the sort of circles that would know much of the truth behind even the most horrifying and unprovable speculations. So their request didn't necessarily imply a breach of security. Even so, he did not particularly relish the thought of going to the old man with such an impertinent offer, and it also meant he would lose some control over his own subcontractors, not the sort of thing that suited his future plans at all.
"I think perhaps I should give this job to Klecker and Associates."
He said it as lazily as possible. He was angry with himself at being caught off balance. Second move to the Baena sisters. The first shape laughed, a snick of sound like a bread knife being drawn across someone's windpipe.
"And waste months and credits while he does the backgrounding? Not to mention trusting the job itself to his team of bravos," added the second, "who will come in like wild bulls and leave hoof prints and horn scars on everything. This is our territory. We have contacts all over that city, and in some very useful sectors of it, too.
Ah, but Klecker won't try to extort me.
The first placed her hands on the table beside her sister's, so that they seemed to be performing a seance.
You have worked with us before. You know we will deliver what you need. And unless you have changed mightily, Signor, you plan to play the role of foreman yourself. Whose preparations would you rather trust your own safety to? Klecker working in a strange place, or us performing in our back garden?
Dredd lifted a hand.
Send me your proposal. I'll consider it.
It has just been transferred.
He curled his fingers. The office and the faceless sisters vanished. He dropped his glass of beer to the floor and watched the last few ounces foam out onto the white carpet. Fury burned in him like a gutful of cinders. The Baines were clearly the right people for the job, and they were right about Klecker and his mercenaries, which meant he'd at least have to talk to the old man, tell him what the sisters had requested, which would mean going back to the mad old bastard on his knees, at least symbolically, again, just like that ancient advertising logo, the dog listening alertly to the radio or whatever it was, his master's voice. Down on all fours like so many times in his childhood before he had learned to answer pain with pain. All those dark nights, screaming under the other boys. His master's voice. He rose and paced back and forth across the small room, his hands fisted so tight his fingernails cut into his own flesh. Rage swelled inside him, making it hard to breathe. He had 3 more interviews to go that night. Minor ones, but he didn't trust himself to handle them properly just now. The Baines had him where they wanted, and they knew it. Ex-whores always knew when they had you by the balls. Answer pain with pain. He walked to the sink and filled his palms with cold water, then splashed it on his face. It matted his hair and dripped from his chin onto his chest, soaking his shirt. His skin felt hot, as though the anger within had heated him like an iron stove. He looked at himself in the mirror, almost expecting to see the water rising from him as steam. His eyes, he noted, were quite wide, so that a rim of white showed all the way around. Relief, that was what he needed, a little something to soothe his thoughts, to cool the tension. An answer to his master's voice. Through his small window he could see the saurian hump of the bridge and the vast scatter of shimmering lights that was Greater Sydney. It was not hard to look down on that pulse and glitter and imagine each light as a soul, and that he, like God in his high place, could just reach out and extinguish any one of them, or all of them. Before he could get any more work done, he decided, he would have to get a little exercise. Then he would feel stronger. The way he liked to feel. He turned up his inner music and went to get his sharp things.
I do not doubt it is true, said the god. I ask, is it acceptable?
The rest of the Ennead stared back at him with the eyes of beasts. Eternal twilight filled the broad windows of the Western Palace and steeped the entire room in a bluish light which oil lamps could not entirely dispel. Osiris lifted his flail.
Is it acceptable? He repeated.
Ptah, the artificer, bowed slightly, although Osiris doubted that Ptah's real-life counterpart had done anything like it. That was one of the advantages of the Brotherhood conducting its meetings on his own virtual turf. His governing systems could insert at least a modicum of courtesy. As if to prove that the bow had not been his own gesture, Ptah snapped back.
No, damn it! Of course it's not acceptable, but this stuff is very new. You have to expect the unexpected.
Osiris paused before replying, allowing his anger to cool. Most of the other members of the Brotherhood's High Council were at least as stiff-necked as he was. It would do no good to put them on the defensive.
I simply want to know how we can lose someone whom we ourselves placed in the system, he said at last. How can he have disappeared?
We have his body, for God's sake!
He frowned at this accidental self-mockery, and folded his arms across his bandaged chest. Ptah's yellow face creased in a smile. He had a typical American disrespect for authority, and no doubt thought Osiris VR habitat grandiose.
Yes, we certainly do have his body,
and if that was all we cared about, we could eliminate him at any time. But you were the one who wanted this particular edition, although I've never understood why. We're working in unknown territory here, especially with all the variables our own experiments have added to the mix. It's like expecting objects to behave the same way in deep space that they do back on Earth. It seems pretty damn unfair to blame my people when it goes a little flippy.
This man has not been kept alive solely on a whim. I have good reasons, even though they are private. Osiris spoke as firmly and calmly as he could. He did not wish to appear capricious, especially in argument with Ptah. If anyone was likely to challenge his leadership in days to come, it was the American. In any case, it is unfortunate. We are nearing the crisis point, and Ra cannot be kept waiting much longer.
Jesus wept!
Falcon-headed Horus banged a fist down on the basalt table.
Ra! What the hell are you talking about now?
Osiris stared. The black, emotionless bird eyes stared back. Another American, of course. It was like dealing with children, albeit very powerful children.
You are in my house, he said as calmly as he could. It would not harm you to show some respect, or at least courtesy.
He allowed the sentence to hang in the air for a moment, giving ample time for the various other Brotherhood members to think what might harm Horus, to think of all the things an angry Osiris could do.
If you would avail yourself of the information provided, you would know that Ra is my name for the final phase of the Grail Project. If you are too busy, my system will be happy to translate for you so you do not impede the flow of conversation during meetings. I'm not here to play games.
The bird-headed god's bluster had abated somewhat. Horus scratched his chest vigorously, making Osiris wince with distaste.
You're the chairman, so we play with your toys. We're your Sims, whatever, fair enough. But I'm a busy man, and I don't have time to download your newest set of rules every time I hook up.
Enough squabbling!
Unlike the others, Sekhmet seemed quite comfortable in her goddess guise. Osiris thought she would enjoy wearing the lion's head in real life. She was a natural deity. No corruptive notions of democracy had ever sullied her outlook.
Should we eliminate this loose end, this lost man? What does our chairman want?
Thank you for asking. Osiris leaned back in his tall chair. For reasons of my own, I wish him to be found. If enough time goes by without success, then I will allow him to be killed. But that is a clumsy solution.
Actually, it's not only clumsy, Ptah offered cheerfully. It may not be a solution at all. At this point, we might not be able to kill him. At least not the part of him resident in the system.
A slender hand was lifted. The others turned, their attention drawn by the rarity of Thoth having anything to say.
Surely things have not gone so far already, he asked.
His narrow ibis head nodded sorrowfully, the beak dipping down to his chest.
Have we lost control of our own virtual environments? That would be a very distressing event. I would have to think carefully before continuing my commitment. We must have more control of the process than this.
Osiris started to reply, but Ptah leaped in quickly.
There are always perturbations at the edge of any paradigm shift, he said. It's like storms on the edge of a weather front. We expect them as a generality without being able to anticipate them exactly. I'm not worried about this, and I don't think you should be either.
A fresh spate of argument broke out around the table, but this time Osiris was not displeased. Thoth was of the careful Asian character that did not like sudden changes or bold assertions, and almost certainly did not like American abruptness. Ptah had not done himself any favors. Thoth and his Chinese consortium were a large and important power block in the Brotherhood. Osiris had been cultivating them for decades. He made a note to contact Thoth privately later and deal carefully with his concerns. Meanwhile, some of the Chinese tycoon's irritation would undoubtedly localize around Ptah and his Western contingent.
"Please, please," he said at last. "I will be happy to talk to any of you individually who are worried about this. The problem, however minor,
has its source in my own personal initiative. I take complete responsibility. That at least silenced the table, and behind the emotionless Sims, behind the beetle mandibles, the masks of hippo, ram, and crocodile, he knew that calculations were being made, odds were being re-examined, but he also knew that his prestige was such that even self-satisfied Ptah would not argue with him any further, at risk of seeming divisive. Were it not for the Grail at the end of this long, wearisome road, he thought, I would happily see the whole of this greedy lot buried in a mass grave. It is sad that I need the Brotherhood so badly. This thankless chairmanship is like trying to teach table manners to piranha. Behind his corpse mask, he smiled briefly, although the various teeth and fangs glinting along the length of the table lent the image a certain unpleasant ring of truth. Now, if we have dispatched other business, and if the problem of our little runaway has been tabled for the time being, there is only one other thing, the matter of our former colleague Shu. He turned to Horace with mock concern. You do realize that Shu is only a code name, another little bit of Egyptiana? A joke of sorts, actually, since Shu was the sky god who abdicated the throne of heaven in favor of Ra. You do understand that, General? We have so few living ex-colleagues, I felt sure you would not require translation. The falcon eyes glittered. I know who you're talking about.
Good.
In any case, I took it as the sense of our last full meeting that Shu has become, since retirement, a liability to the old firm. He allowed himself a dusty chuckle. I have initiated certain processes designed to reduce that liability as much as possible.
Say what you mean.
Sekhmet's tongue lolled from her tawny muzzle.
The one you call Shu is to be killed?
Osiris leaned back. Your grasp of our needs is admirable, madam, but overly simple. There is more to be done than that.
I could have a black bag team on top of him in 12 hours. Clear out the whole compound. Burn it to the foundations. Take the gear back home for study.
Horace lifted a hand to his hooked beak, an odd gesture that Osiris needed several seconds to decode. Back in R.L., the general had lit himself a cigar. Thank you. But this is a weed whose roots go deep. Shu was a founding member of our Ennead. Excuse me, General. Of our Brotherhood. Such roots must be carefully uncovered, and the whole plant taken in one reaping. I have initiated such a process, and I will lay the plans before you at our next meeting, with just enough obvious flaws in them to give imbeciles like you something to piss upon, General. Osiris was impatient now for the meeting to end. Then I will thank you for your clever suggestions, and you will let me get on with the real business of protecting our interests. Anything else? Then I thank you for joining me. I wish you all good luck in your various projects. One by one, the gods winked out, until Osiris was alone again. The austere lines of the Western Palace had been transmuted into the lamp-lit homeliness of a Bidas that was. The scent of myrrh and the chants of the resurrected priests rose around him like the soothing waters of a warm bath. He dared not bring the full panoply of his godliness to the Brotherhood's gatherings. He was already regarded as slightly, although harmlessly, eccentric, but he was far more comfortable being Osiris now than the all-too-mortal man underneath, and he missed the comforts of his temple when he was forced to leave it. He crossed his arms across his chest and called forward one of his high priests. "Summon the Lord of the Mummy Wrappings. I am ready now to grant him audience." The priest, whether software or sim, the god could not guess and did not care, hurried away into the darkness at the back of the temple. A moment later, the arrival of Anubis was proclaimed by a skirling fanfare. The priests fell back, pressing themselves against the temple walls. The dark jackal head was raised and alert, as though testing the air. The god was not certain whether he liked this change from the messenger's usual sullenness. "I'm here." The god stared at him for a moment. It was appropriate, this guise he had chosen for his favorite tool. He had spotted the youth's potential quite early, and had devoted many years to raising him. Not like a son, heaven forbid, but like a trained hound, shaping him to the tasks for which he was best suited. but like any spirited beast, this one sometimes became over-exuberant, or even defiant. Sometimes a taste of the whip was necessary, but he had been giving Anubis more than a taste lately, and that was unfortunate. Too much punishment dulled its effect. Perhaps this was an occasion to try something a little different. "I am not happy about your South American subcontractors," he began. The jackal head lowered slightly, anticipating a rebuke. "They are impertinent, to say the least." "They are, Grandfather." Too late, Anubis remembered his master's dislike of that particular honorific. The narrow muzzle flinched again, ever so slightly. The god pretended it hadn't happened. "But I know how such things can be. The best are often ambitious in their own right. They think they know more than those who employ them, even when their employers have invested time and money in their training." The sharp-eared head tilted, just like a real canine expressing puzzlement. Anubis was wondering what other message was being delivered here. "In any case, if they are the best for the job, you must employ them. I have seen their request, and I am now sending you the terms within which you may bargain with them."
"You are going to deal with them?"
"We are going to hire them. If they fail to serve to our satisfaction, they will, of course, not receive the reward they seek. If they do perform, well, I will consider at that time whether to honor the bargain." There was a pause in which he could sense the messenger's disapproval. The god was amused. Even murderers had a sense of propriety.
"If you cheat them, the word will travel very quickly."
"If I cheat them, I will be very sure to do it in such a way that no one will ever know. If they happen to meet with an accident, for instance, it will be something so clearly not of our doing that you need not worry about your other contacts taking fright." The god laughed. "You see, my faithful one, you have not learned everything from me yet, after all. Perhaps you should wait a little longer before thinking to strike out on your own." Anubis responded slowly.
"And how do I know you will not someday do the same to me?"
The god leaned forward to lay his flail almost lovingly against the jackal's sloping forehead. "Rest assured, my messenger, if I saw the need, I would. If you rely solely on my honor to protect you, you are not the servant in whom I wish to place my trust." End of Side 8. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette. Side 9. City of Golden Shadow. Other Land, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 261. Behind the mask, behind the complexity of instrumentation, Osiris smiled as he watched Anubis quite visibly consider whatever safeguards he had put in place to protect himself against his master. But betrayal is a tool that must be used very discreetly. The god continued, "It is only because I am known for honoring my agreements that I could, if I wished, dispose of these overly forward sisters. Remember, honor is the only really good disguise for an occasional act of dishonor. No one trusts a known liar."
"I observe and learn, O Lord."
"Good. I am glad to find you in a receptive mood. Perhaps you will give your careful attention to this as well?" The god flicked his crook, and a small box appeared in the air, hovering before his throne. Inside it was a grainy hologrammatic representation of two men wearing disheveled suits, standing on either side of a desk. They might have been salesmen, except for the photographs spread across the desk's untidy surface. "See the pictures there?" Osiris asked. "We are lucky the public constabulary's financial restraints mean they still rely on two-dimensional representations. Otherwise, this might make for quite a dizzying effect, not unlike the mirrors in a barber shop." He expanded the cube until the figures were life-size, and the photos could be easily viewed.
"Why are you showing me this?"
"Oh, come now." The god nodded, and the two figures inside the cube sprang into life.
"Number 4. No difference," the first man was saying, "except this time the writing was on the victim herself, not on something she was carrying."
He pointed to one of the photos. The word "Sang" was printed in block capitals across her stomach.
the bloody letters smearing into the greater redness below.
And still no hits on it? A name? A place? I assume we've given up on the possibility of it being a reference to informing. None of these peoples were informers. These are ordinary folk.
The first cop shook his head in frustration.
And once again we've got blurring on the surveillance cameras, like someone took an electromagnet to them. But the lab says no magnet was used. Shit.
The second cop stared at the pictures.
Shit, shit, shit! Something'll come up.
The first man sounded almost convincing.
These blokes always screw up somewhere along the line. Get cocky, you know. Or they just get too crazy.
The god gestured, and the cube dwindled away to a spark.